And CSIRO, the place I work for, I should explain, is a government research organisation. The lab I come from, this is in Sydney, you can't see so well, but there's a the Harbour Bridge and the Opera House is around about here, so we're pretty close to the city, in a nice bushy area. And Australia has a lot to be grateful for, and that's what I want to talk about today because of the Josephson effect. And I thought though I'd explain where we come from in Australia, relating to why we spent so much time worrying about applications. So the organisation is CSIRO, has been around for 86 years, and we're worried about things from getting rid of the rabbits and prickly pear to developing atomic mass spectrometer, radio astronomy, and we even have put the permanent press and non-crease in your trousers, so you'd be very happy about that with our fiber work. But we also have invented the plastic banknotes, and probably something which is probably most relevant at the moment in the jubilee of our queen, I should say, was that we actually did a science experiment on her developing Aerogard, which is a insect repellent, and it was developed in time for when the queen visited in 1962 and 63. And in fact, she was the first person to use it to keep the flies off her. So. But we're very grateful to Brian because, in actual fact, what I'm going to be convincing you today is that he saved the Australian economy. And the reason for that is we all know only too well about the global financial crisis. But Australia, surprisingly, this is in 2009 when it was pretty grim, Australia actually kept on growing. And there's a good reason for that. If you go through and trail through some of the media things, this is from the ABC News, and I'll explode that bit there, said that Western Australia's resources kept delivering billions of dollars worth of royalties during the economic downturn. And then this was something last year where Lantem, which is a system I'll describe, and I apologise, in Australia we can't spell nickel, but it was basically saying that Lantem, which is a system I'll be describing, was actually the basis for being the backbone of the nickel industry. So you'll see there's this connection here. And it's all dependent on this one thing, which is the grain boundary of that causes the Josephson junction in YBCO. And this is a transmission electron micrograph, which was done by Emma Mitchell, one of my colleagues. So before we get into this, though, I should probably put this into context a little bit and explain that it's not one measurement that leads to the discovery of a mine. So this is Geophysics 101. So yeah, this is a cross-section. So this is looking under the earth, and there's often these mineral deposits here buried with a range of different materials around it. The first thing they do, though, is fly aeroplanes or helicopters across. And what they're looking for is at line spacings at about 200 metres. They use a range of different techniques I've listed there. If they find something interesting, then they get a poor person going across the ground, going through, doing measurements, again, getting finer and finer grades. And then they eventually get to a point where they start putting down very expensive boreholes. And unfortunately, if you're like this one here where you miss it, you can end up with very expensive outcomes so that you can miss an ore body altogether. And so trying to understand exactly where the ore body is absolutely essential. And when eventually they get to a point where they can find the ore body, and you can see here this one's a classic where it's which is something which our SWID system helped discover. And you can see it's linked in between different things which are like volcanic. I'm not a geophysicist at all, but you can see it's squashed in between here. And this is a $100 million bit of nickel sulfide deposit there, which they found very useful for that particular company. And then what they do is they find these discoveries, and then they put press releases out here, and you can see here, I think it's quite interesting, saying for personal use only, which is sort of a hint saying, please buy our shares because we've found something really wonderful. And if you go through trailing through the internet, look for Lantem, and it might give you a hint on where to buy your next shares. So very quickly, to remind yourselves, there's three sorts of magnetic measurements that are used in mineral exploration. The first is just a scale of value, where you're looking at the total field. The next one is a vector, where you're just looking at X, Y, and Z directions. And then the third one is looking at the gradients, where you're looking at the spatial variation of a magnetic field. And they all tell you, or can tell you, different things. However, if you're going to go through and use a magnetic measurement, there's different techniques, and this is just a classic figure of merit. So this is the noise here with frequency. You've seen some of these today. Hall measurements are not so sensitive. You go through this for various different sensors, but you can see that squid sensors are very low noise indeed. The ones with liquid helium cooled are the ones which are historically being used in the past, and I'll refer to those, but the ones which I've been developing are the high TC ones. But there was something which I guess was really important in the whole process of saying, should we be using a squid or not? And this goes back to something which, if any of you look at the NATO lectures in squids, which Harold Weinstock organised, he had an important maxim which I've used all along and it's been absolutely essential, and that is you never use a squid if you can use another sort of magnetometer, because it's such a pain to use in the normal sorts of applications. So let's go back and do a walkthrough, quick walkthrough history. I mean, we heard about the Ford Motor Car Company and Arnold telling us about the discovery or the an invention of squids. And his colleagues, who would be interested to hear a little bit more about who they worked with, they didn't figure in his story. Bogertz and Mornick went out and using this system here, which I hate to admit doesn't look too different from many of the systems we see in the laboratory still today, where you have the probe, slightly less modern electronics. But they went out and were able to do the first measurements looking at the fluctuations in the vertical gradient of the Earth's magnetic field over time. Jim Zimmerman also went out and did a range of different measurements some years later. He went through and had a very frustrating experience looking for the ionospheric current and looking at the equatorial electrojet during a solar eclipse. And he was unsuccessful. He did two different sorts of measurements at different stages. And part of that was because he wasn't ready in time with something which John Clark actually was involved with. And that's... which I'll talk about in a moment. But Jim, nevertheless, was part of this group that set up the SHE Corporation, which was the first commercialisation of squid systems. And I think I rather like the trendy 70s people here going out in the field carrying, you can see a very large container here which has got the squids in it with liquid helium. John Clark was also, and Berkeley University had an interest in geophysics and geophysical exploration. And this is a picture which he supplied for me around the time of 1982, where you can see the system, squid system, he buried under in the ground, the reason being to avoid wind blowing it around and creating a vibration noise. But the thing which John is most famous for is something that's been really enduring, and that is the idea of remote referencing, which if Jim Zimmerman had, he probably would have been able to achieve the measurements he was looking for. And the idea is that you have two squid systems here. These were ones where one was an RF one and a DC one, and I'm assuming, John, it was because that was what was available at hand at the time. And you have one measuring in one near where you want to have the measurement done, another somewhere in a remote location, and then you can reference against that, and it helps you to reduce the background noise and be able to see through beyond the problems of being able to measure a magnetic field which is very small around the Earth's magnetic field, which is relatively speaking quite large. In 1980, though, there was this a workshop which was organised by Bill Overton and Harold Weinstock, and this was absolutely amazing. It was at this workshop in New Mexico where a whole lot of people came and presented a range of papers looking at how you could use superconducting devices for geophysics. And what was extraordinary was that every single paper is a benchmark, and we still today go back to that as a starting point for any application. Very much ahead of its time. I went through looking at a range of different things which are listed here as just some examples, but the new squid technology was something which was highlighted. And as I mentioned, each paper was a benchmark, and it's something which is quite extraordinary back in 1980. The problem was that the squids did not take off in geophysics. And that was partly because helium is tricky to use in the field, although recently the people in Yana have been using that, and we actually made a system for BHP Billiton as well. But it still is tricky to use in the field. And if you're wanting to go to very remote locations like in Tanzania in Africa, you can't do it at all. The other is also the slew rate, which is the ability of the electronics to be able to keep track of the electrical signal. Was never high enough, and so therefore quite often the system would go out of lock or was unable to follow the measurement it was trying to do, and so therefore had to be reset and started again, and that was frustrating and sometimes prevented a measurement occurring. But the main thing was cost, and that the cost of the SQUID system and the electronics was not possible. And so as a consequence, there was a limited application. In fact, by the time in the early or middle 80s, it was pretty much non-existent, other than in the laboratory. And that goes back to the company which was formed by Bill Gorey and Bill Goodman, one small and one so large. And they used a low TC SQUID system to do to create the ability to measure rock magnetism. So they go through, take many samples of rocks, run it through their rock magnetism system to be able to measure the paleomagnetic signature of the rocks. And this system's used in, there's more than 100 of them around the world in any geophysics lab, and they're able to measure magnetic moment. What was important with this system was that they created this re-liquefying helium system, which meant that you didn't have to have very many fills between filling up with helium to when you needed to fill it again. And that was very important for laboratory use. And these days, I imagine that they're probably introducing some of the new systems which are very good indeed with helium re-liquefication. But what was interesting with this was that it led to the verification of plate tectonics, which was the idea that you had continental drift. And what they were able to do was go through and do measurements of rock samples that showed the variations of the Earth's magnetic field, which flipped with time, and so therefore was able to show the spreading or seafloor spreading, and we're able to go through and verify that. So that's an outcome from superconducting devices which wouldn't have been possible in any other way. But then this all changed in 1987 with the discovery of high-TC superconductors. And if you look at this New York Times front page, was Woodstock of Physics, which I'm sure many of you were at the Hilton Hotel, and people crushing into the ballroom there to be able to hear the latest and greatest. It was even on the front page of Time magazine a couple of months later. And CSIRO at that stage pulled together a team of people, which I was one of them, in order to take this yttrium barium copper oxide material, which is up here, make it into, what we had to do is make it into a junction, and this is the TEM I showed you before, where we were able to create the Josephson junction by the grain boundary. And you can see here the planes, the copper oxide planes here, and then swinging across at the junction formed on this step edge here, so that we had a grain boundary here and we had a rounded bottom, which I'll show another cross section of that. This was then placed into the junction, which was placed into a squid, which looks like that. And that was probably a whole talk in itself, which I won't go into detail, other than sort of showing this this nice cross section here. We can see we've got the grey boundary here and then this rounded bottom here. What was important with this is we've got an MgO substrate, and the way that the yttrium barium copper oxide grows on the step edge is actually quite different to other substrates. And as a consequence, when Ling Ho, who was doing her PhD at Strathclyde University with John McFarland and Gordon Donaldson, well, she took some of our samples and looked at their behaviour in magnetic fields, which I'll show you the results in a moment. But one of the things which we found was that the problem with many high-TC devices, or SWID devices, was that these resonant tunnelling sites and also trapped and escapes of quasi-particles going across the junction, such as a semiconductor on either side, a superconductor on either side with the insulator in between, caused a significant amount of 1 over F noise. And this was one of the things that plagued devices for applications in unshielded conditions, which you need for geophysics. So what she did was do some nice measurements looking at the critical current fluctuations over applied magnetic fields. And this is the bicrystal samples that she used, and then these were two other sorts of junctions on step edges. And then this is the sort of junctions that we made here, and you can see that there's significantly low noise, which meant that when we use these devices in unshielded applications, we are able to get the devices to work really well in unshielded conditions and sometimes even in motion. So since then, we've been developing our devices, and this is our most recent ones now. So you can see they're quite sophisticated looking chips. And this is an example of a shielded and unshielded device here. And you can see it's getting quite low noise there, down to 30 to 50 femtotesla per root hertz in the white noise area. So what I'm going to do quickly now is go through how we've applied those devices to mineral exploration, and particularly for the one we've made most famous for and successful for is transient electromagnetics, which is an active technique. So I'm going to explain how this is done. This is useful for conductors, so things like gold, silver, or nickel. And so if you have a coil that's put on the top of the surface, and you pulse a current through it, it creates an eddy current in a conductor. And so during the off time, if you put a current in and then measure it during the off period with any sort of magnetic sensor, you're able to get an idea with time as to what's present under the soil. So let's just look at the measurement here. This is, we turn on the coil's current, and then we turn it off. And during that off time, we average between 100 microseconds up to 30 millisecond time frame. So you have one channel which will have about 100 microseconds, and then as time goes on, we gather information for longer, and we bundle it up or put it into these different channels and average it. Each one of those measurements gives you an idea of the signal that comes from a particular depth. So this is near the surface, and this is deep into the soil here. And then we go through and we take a measurement and then pick up the sample, the measurement system, and move down a traverse or down a paddock where you're doing the measurements. So this is so that then you link up all the different measurements taken at a particular time in each channel. So let's just rotate that around. That gives you an idea of it rotating, and see what it looks like here. And this is sort of the measurements that we measure. So this is going through depth here, so that this is near the surface to deep, and then this is going along doing a measurement. And what you're looking for are these sort of lumps here. And this is where the SQUID system was most successful, because it was measuring the B field directly, as opposed to coils which measure the time variation. And one of the issues is that with the time variation, you were never sure where, if you were going to integrate it, where you put the integration levels boundary conditions, and so you could make anything look like you've got a mineral deposit there, which was causing sorts of griefs for the mining companies, where they thought they had a mineral deposit and it actually wasn't there. When they get that information, then they're able to run it through programs, which gives an idea of, there's meant to be some red there, but anyway, let's pretend there's a red blob here, and they're able to get conductivity cross-sections, and then overlay what they think the geology looks like to determine where they're going to where their mines are. So this is a compilation of information that was from our measurements we did in the Raglan project, which is in the Arctic region in Canada. And they were having terrible trouble seeing this ore body, which was here, because it was covered up by all the material that was around about, which prevented this being seen by the coil technique, which was normally used. And by seeing this result here with the SQUID data, superconducting devices were suddenly seen as something really worthwhile. So in 1992, we did our first field trial, and that's in Cooper Pedy, which any of you who are interested in opals will know that's our main opal town. And that's Graham Sloggett there, who unfortunately died about 17 years ago from cancer, doing some measurements there. You can see the SQUID systems there underneath a garbage bin, which was used to protect it from wind. And you can see everyone sort of... when you're doing field trials, you always see people sort of head down looking at oscilloscopes, trying to be able to determine the measurement, because it's so bright, normally you can't see the screen very well. And over the years, we went from... This is our first system here, which was, we called it the Rocket, and that was the measurement we did at Cooper Pedy. But over time, we made improvements until the system, which is now the commercial system called Land10, which was licensed by a company called Outer Rim Exploration Services. So this is the sensor system here with the Dewar. John Clark showed you, this is sort of, I guess, our advertising shot, which shows the Dewar here with the control electronics. And then this is the system, this yellow box here, which puts the pulse through the coil at the top of the surface. just to give you an idea of, this is where we did some of our early trials in Raglan. It was down in the snow there, and you can see here we've got a plastic crate which you buy, you know, at the equivalent of Woolworths or whatever, and we put the electronics in there just to keep it under control. So we had to take it from a science experiment through to something which was commercial and robust and could go, for example, on the back of a Speedoo or on the back of a truck, fall off if need be and still survive. What really made the big headway for us, though, was this result here. This is in Cannington near Mount Isa in Queensland. And this was BHP Billiton had done this measurement and were very excited by what they thought here was a major silver deposit discovery. And they thought, well, just before we, since we were interacting and collaborating with them, they thought they'd run our squid system over the top. And this is what the results look like here. And this was really critical, because what this showed was that they actually had not one load here. There's actually two loads. And as a consequence, the geophysicist said, before you put your borehole down, instead of putting it at this point here, let's move it to this point here. And the Cannington Silver Mine, which I'll show you a picture of it, which is this now, was actually able to come online. If they'd put it in their original place, they would have missed it altogether. So this is the biggest silver mine in the world. It's worth $2 billion. So thank you, Brian. As a consequence of now we don't do anything much about this. This is if you go to geophysics conferences, which are huge conferences with 6,000 to 10,000 people, and they have exhibitions there. They have booths like this trying to flog the system and get people to use it, and it's all by. And there's, I don't even know how many there are. I asked the company, I said it's confidential now how many they have, but it's between 15 and 20 of these systems being used around the world. We're not the only group that have worked in this area. In fact, it's become very competitive because other groups who work in superconducting devices are interested in trying to get their fair share of it, and particularly the Jena group have been good competitors. This is just to show you what's a little bit different with our system. We actually, instead of having a stick with as the probe with the squids at the bottom, we had what we called a stickless probe, and we had our dewar here, which was glass, not foam or some of the other ones that are being used. And this was actually taken from a dewar, sort of $9 from Kmart. And then we coated it with a special screening of aluminium foil for RF, keeping RF out. And then we had the devices in a little holder at the bottom, the three axes there. And then we just had wires coming up so that 1 litre of liquid nitrogen was able to be held for over 24 hours. And it was very compact, and you can see here, this is our airborne system, but you can see here it's nice and compact, and this is the three axes of electronics. And it also had to be used in, outback Australia, where it can be up to 45 degrees, and also in the Arctic, where it can be minus 20 degrees or even less. And one of the things, this is where Kent said that we were worried about using cryogens. In actual fact, it's fabulous having a cryogen because it means you get nice uniform temperature and less, of course, you don't get temperature fluctuations, which for any measurement device is always a real problem. But over the time, getting industry adoption was a real problem because flux gates exist. And there was a concern that why do we want to use cryogens when we could use a flux gate instead. And so we had to go out and spend a lot of time convincing the geophysics industries and the mining industries that in fact squids were able to see more than you could see with flux gates. And this is a bake-off we did. So this is again, this is depth here, and this is the distance along a paddock. This is early and this is late time. So this is near this surface and this is deep in the ground. And one of the things you can see here, at early stages, the squid and the flux gate are very similar, but it's getting these deep ore bodies that really made a difference. And this bake-off was actually absolutely critical for industry adoption. But even though we found lots of mineral deposits, you'd think they'd be wanting to use it. They would be happy to have it, but it took us a long time to convince them that that was actually a worthwhile thing. That was about in 1984, and now it's 2004, but now it's something which is highly sought after. We've also flown them behind an aircraft, and there you are, the system in a bird behind an aeroplane. And it was necessary here to develop suspension systems, so if you don't have a good suspension system, the noise is very high. They do the measurements around about here at about 30 hertz, and you can see that for the good suspension system, you get the same noise level as on the ground. There's a picture of the suspension system. So just very quickly, gradiometers are another application or another area that you can use squids for mineral exploration. And this is looking at the spatial variation. And I'll just quickly flip through some work that's been done by the Yana people, where they've been very successful in using low TC devices. And this is the development of their system over a 5-year period. But also being able to get maps from this. But we went one step further and said we want to be able to use a low TC system, a high TC system for this. Because there's no axial gradiometer that's available for this, we developed a rotating gradiometer. And this is using flexible tapes, so we used Hastelloy tapes with YVCO on it and as a pickup loop with a squid attached to it. And then we developed a cryogen-free helium dewar, nitrogen dewar, so that you had a dewar within a dewar, so this was just rotating in gas. And then this is what the head looks like. And we did various field trials, so that's out near a wine country in Gulgong in New South Wales, and we were able to get, this is looking at the dipole moment as a comparison with theory here, and then, and again, being able to get maps. And now we're in the process of flying this, and it's used for defence as well as mineral exploration applications. And you can see this device here in the helicopter, the device up here, the electronics at the end. And this is what the measurements look like. So again, against theory, you can see here the dipole moment here against theory, and then this is looking up close where you can sort of see the implications of noise. We've also developed another system which you can't always rotate a system, and so this is one using the idea of the Landau brothers, and this is having planar gradiometers, which you can see here, there's six of them, and putting in a configuration with liquid nitrogen. And I want to show this in particular because John Clark will remember this. This is where we did some field trials, and this is, John, where we went on our little bush work, complete with leeches and everything earlier this year. And just to give you an idea, this is our laboratory here in A, and then this is just where we did the measurements. So it's not so far away from the lab. You can sort of see what it looks like when you're doing a field trial, as it can be cold and wet. And this is Shane Keenan, who is a postdoc who's been working with us for some time developing this system. And you can see here the system being used. And they've done some very nice work here where I've gone through showing. The green one here is the system shielded in the lab, then unshielded in the lab in black, and then when it's unshielded in application, you can see here when you get away from all the EM noise in the laboratory, you're able to get it operating close to a shielded condition in laboratory. So it's a very good result. And this is just the measurement showing they ran a magnet past it and being able to compare that with their signal they expected theoretically. So just to whip through other devices we're developing in CSIRO, so that high TC devices aren't just used for squids, but we can also use them for heterodyne oscillators, which we're developing for front-end receivers so that it can be used there. This is nice work done by Jardu. And also for terahertz imaging, where we're using it to be able to look through, I guess the best way of looking at it is looking through things like a purse to be able to see, how about I do it this way, Superman vision is probably the best way to do it. So you're able to see through the clothing and be able to do it for detection of things you don't want to see passing through. And then finally, is that we hope that in 10 years' time we'll be seeing, this is a mock-up of a website where you're able to say superconducting devices are just something we buy like transistors and resistors, and so I guess that's probably a little bit questionable there, but I'm looking forward to the day when you actually just buy a superconducting device just like any other device and use it. And I just want to acknowledge the team at CSIRO. We've got a team of people. It's something which has required a lot of work from not just the device fabricators, the theorists, the electronics engineers and cryogenics engineers and mechanical engineers. It's been a real big team effort. But finally, I want to thank Brian. So Brian, this is you came forward and helped us to come up with this idea of a single grain boundary that meant that we were able to have mines in Australia. That's meant that Australia was able to get through the global financial crisis and come in on top. So on behalf of Australia, I thank you.
Wonderful talk.
So
we have time for
maybe
one question.
Well, of course, everything works better colder. These days, probably, I mean, your grass sets are very impressive. You have 1 litre of nitrogen that lasts for 24 hours. I'm a specialist in ultra, in paraffin-free systems. And I guess for transport, for easy transport, these days you could certainly, with 1 kilowatt, you can produce 4 Kelvin or 0.3 Kelvin. Mm. And almost everything works better colder. Jim Zimmerman, of course, used to have planned to make a cryogen-free device which he could power with a bicycle wheel. You reckon you needed about 50 watts to get to 4 Kelvin. With a suitable sort of GM cooler. So maybe it's not impossible to want to no temperature.
For 4.2 Kelvin?
Yeah.
Actually, the problem, for mineral exploration though unshielded, you actually don't gain that much because you've got the naturally occurring Earth's magnetic field, and so it does swamp it. In fact, our low TC and high TC systems aren't too different in noise. That's in field applications. The other thing that's really interesting is that it's often easier to have a bucket full of liquid nitrogen and take that with you into remote areas than to have something which requires a generator or batteries in order to run.
Yeah.
So in many ways, for mineral exploration, having something with a cryogen is actually an advantage.
Okay, any more questions? Yeah, Paul.
I wondered if you can distinguish between different ores at all.
Oh, okay. Well, different techniques, you might use different things. So, for example, the transient electromagnetic technique, LANTEM, is only good for conductors. But gragnometers are best for things like kimberlite pipes where diamonds are, and also iron ores, magnetic materials. So you won't pick up the silver and gold because it doesn't have magnetic moment. So it's... But there is a technique also where you can measure you can apply a field and then measure the remnant field and do the ratio of it. It's called the Kronisberger ratio. And from that you can tell what material there is because it's sort of like an ideality factor. And so that actually hasn't been used much though in aggression in the field because at the moment the main reason is that it takes a while to do the measurements. And the whole thing with mineral exploration is being in there, do it quickly, do it fast, because the biggest cost these days is actually the labour cost in doing the testing. So if you can do it quickly, then that saves them a lot of money. And that's what they're all about. It might be large amounts of money, but they're very low margins, so they've got to look at doing it cheaply. And that technique, the Kronisberger technique, takes a long time to do.
Okay, thank you, Cassie.